Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies titled The Political Economy of Recovery in Southern Europe 2014 to 2018. Our speaker is Manos Matsiganis, Associate Professor of Public Finance at Polytechnic University of Milan, Italy. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Sophia Perez, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston University.
I am extremely pleased to introduce today our visiting scholar, Manos Matsiganis, who is also has been a co-author of mine on some work. Manos is an eminent economist who is specialized actually in questions of equality and inequality as well as labor markets. And he, and in some cases I myself, have been looking at the consequences of the deep economic recession that the countries of Southern Europe have experienced over the last decade. And this is also the topic that Manos will talk about today. So without further ado, and for the interest of time, Manos, please go ahead.
Thank you, Sophia. Thank you all for, well, first of all, for having me here today to listen to what I have to say. So, this is the structure of my presentation. I'll say a few words about this research. Today, I'm going to really kickstart research that we are doing with Sophia here on the political economy of recovery in Southern Europe. That comes at the heels of a paper that was published a few months ago on the political economy of austerity in Southern Europe. So the first paper, the previous paper, looked at roughly the period from 2008 to 2014. Now we are hoping to look at the more recent period, say from 2014 to now, more or less. So our research questions are basically these three. We hope to look at the extent to which labor market reforms under the austerity have somehow prejudiced or shaped the way the economies have recovered. The second question is about how labor market reforms, but also the way the recovery, the economy is performing more recently, have affected inequality and poverty, the distribution of incomes, basically, and also the role of political actors, on which I have strong opinions, but I will let Sophia do all the work, or most of it. So today I'm not going to talk at all about politics, sadly. I'm going to say a few things about the first question and very few about the second one. So what do we know? What do the figures tell us? Well, as ECFIN, the economy branch of the European Commission, has triumphantly announced, the European economy, the EU economy, grew by 2.2%. Hooray. Which doesn't sound much, but given earlier performance, it's pretty good. First of all, it's faster than expected. And then it was kind of equally shared, broadly shared, in the sense that for the first time in God knows how many years, all EU member states grew in 2017. Their economies did. So that was good. This is a funny graph that looks at forecasts. And of course, the further left you look, the more early, the earlier the forecasts are. So these are forecasts for the year 2017. Somewhere around here at the right part of the graph, reality catches up with forecasts. And what this graph is telling you is what I just said before, that reality turned out to be a bit rosier than forecast, except in the case of Greece, that has been forecast to grow a lot for 3 or 4 years, and it doesn't, not as much at least. Although, as I just said, in 2017, Greece also grew. Of course, if you take a broader picture, if you look at how European economies, southern European economies, performed since, say, the mid-1990s, you will see once again what you already know, that Greece, Portugal, and Spain grew a lot in the second part of the 1990s. Then Portugal sort of stagnated, but Greece and Spain continued to grow much faster than the rest of the EU until the onset of the Eurozone crisis. And then there was a reckoning. Spain, Greece, and to some extent the other countries too experienced a deep recession. In the case of Greece, it was deeper and longer than more or less anything witnessed in world history outside major wars, very similar to the US Great Depression in size, not in depth, not in duration, and no FDR in sight to kickstart the economy with a new deal. So Greece lost 25% of its GDP in a few years, and then stagnated at a very low level. But of course, the graph also shows you that more recently, Portugal and Spain have started to grow again, which is a good thing. Not so much Italy. Let's look at unemployment. Well, looking at the unemployment rate, which can be slightly misleading, and I will come back to that in a moment, unemployment peaked throughout Europe and throughout Southern Europe sometime around 2013, and then it started to sort of decline pretty rapidly, steeply, in Portugal from a lower level and Spain from a very high level, less rapidly, but still quite well in the case of Greece. In Italy, unemployment never rose that very much, but it hasn't come down that much more recently either. But looking at the unemployment rate alone, as I just said, may be a bit misleading because things have changed. Other things have been happening to do with the labor supply and population movements. For example, migration. All four southern European countries were receiving more migrants than they were sending out up to the late 2000s. But that, Spain most spectacularly, but then was reversed more recently. Both Spain and Greece, and Portugal and Italy more than before, have become net emigration countries. Well, since around, well, in Spain 2005, in Greece later. Greece and Spain have become net emigration countries. Portugal to Italy, not exactly. But even in the case of Italy, there is a kind of exodus. And other research that we are citing shows that the skill level of the new migrants out of Southern Europe is much higher than in earlier migration experiences and higher than the skill level of immigrants to Southern Europe. So this has fed discussions of a brain drain that I'm not going to say much about that today, but of course it's part of the story. So if you look at, I try to neutralize the effect of migration and look not just at unemployment rates or employment rates for that matter, but absolute numbers of workers in employment. So if you do that, you realize that, yes, there has been some job growth in Southern Europe in recent years, but it's not as spectacular as might have been implied by the fall in unemployment rates. And if you compare net job creation since 2013-2014, which is a trough of the labor market, the peak in unemployment, to net job destruction during the crisis, you will find out that in Italy, the ratio between the two is 0.77. That means that Italy has created 77% of the jobs that were lost in the previous period, right? In Portugal, that figure is 64%, Spain 53%, not that great. In Greece, it's pretty bad. Only 29% of the jobs that were lost during the crisis were created more recently. And it's about net job destruction or net job creation, because jobs are created and lost all the time. So it's the net balance that matters. Good. Well, not that good, especially if you compare it to the rest of the EU. In the EU of 28 member states, net job creation since 2013 was 10% better than job destruction, net job destruction in the previous period. So the European economy as a whole is doing quite well. It has more than offset earlier losses. In the euro area, not as good, 0.90, which means that they haven't got there yet in the euro area, but much better than in Southern Europe. It's even less rosy if you take into account that some of the new jobs, apart from being low paid, and I'm going to say a few things about that in a moment, they're also part-time, right? So in terms of hours worked, I'm not going to show hours worked, but if you take into account the fact that part-time employment is on the rise everywhere, but also in Southern Europe, then you see that the employment miracle is less miraculous than may seem at first sight. Okay, I'll move on. Let's look at wages. Well, you know that throughout Europe, wages have hardly grown at all in recent years. You can look at earnings in two ways, per employee or per hour worked. I do both in this graph. Let's stick to wages, hourly wages. In the recovery between 2013 and 2016, which is the year when the latest data are available, real hourly wages in Italy, Portugal, and Greece experienced zero growth. In Spain, slightly better, but below 2%, relative to 3.6% in the euro area. So if you take into account very little growth, no growth perhaps, in Southern Europe in recent years, and you put this in the context of earlier wage losses during the austerity and the crisis, wages today are significantly lower than they had been in 2008. Especially in Portugal, 4.4% in hourly terms, and in Greece, of course, 16%. Over the same period taken as a whole, 2008 to 2016, in the euro area, average wages actually grew by 7.5%, which is not great for a period of 8 years, but it's much better than what is seen in Southern Europe. Inequality and poverty, there isn't much to report on that, except that both the Gini coefficient, which is famously more sensitive to movements around the middle of the income distribution, and the other indicator that the Eurostat uses a lot, the income quintile ratio, which looks at the income share of the richest 20% divided by the income share of the poorest 20% of the population, which by definition is more sensitive to movements at the ends, the high end and the low end of the income distribution. Well, both indicators, it's all very complicated, but I think to cut a long story short, I may say that inequality has risen on both these indicators during the austerity and has stayed high ever since. There is very little evidence of inequality coming down more recently. poverty? Well, the standard poverty rate that we use in Europe, which is proportion of population with an income below 60% of median incomes, equivalized and all the rest, to account for differences in household size, it's a relative poverty indicator. And if you take the proportion of people below X percent of the median, obviously when the median goes down, the poverty threshold also goes down. So it's all very confusing, which is fine in the sense that people do compare themselves, their material circumstances, to those of other people in the society in which they live, which is the standard justification of looking at relative poverty. But I think you can make the argument that at times of rapid change, perhaps people also compare their situation, the current situation, to that experienced a few years ago, just before the whole thing fell apart, in a way. So if you take that view, then you also want to look at the proportion of population below who today have an income that is lower than the poverty threshold of a previous time, adjusted for inflation. And this is what Eurostat also computes. And this is shown in the right-hand panel. The blue line is going through the roof. Almost half of all Greeks, residents of Greece, today have an income that is lower than the poverty threshold of 2008. And it hasn't come down at all in recent years. In Italy and Spain, this kind of poverty indicator didn't rise that much, but again, it has stayed where it was more recently. And I think Portugal, I rather like this graph for Portugal, good for them. It went up by not that much, less than in Italy and Spain, and it has come down again in recent years. So looking at what Eurostat calls anchored poverty, Portugal is doing just as well as the rest of Europe, which is great. And it has come down quite a lot in recent years in relative terms. While I was working on the presentation, I came across this new report by the World Economic Forum in Davos, in Switzerland. They look at the state of the world, blah, blah, blah. And they have come up with this index, the Inclusive Development Index, that looks at the economy, distributional issues, inequality, but also sustainability in all sorts of senses, like intergenerational equity, but also the state of the environment and so on. And they have come with this league table. There is a table for advanced economies and another one for emerging economies. I'm only showing the one on advanced economies. And look at this. The four Southern European countries are in relegation zone. Well, in European soccer, there is relegation. So if you are bottom of the league, you risk ending up in Serie B or something, you know, second division of countries. And this is, I think, interesting. We'll probably leave it out of the paper, but it's good to show. So, summing up what the evidence tells us, I think you can argue that I think it's pretty clear that the recovery is far from complete in Southern Europe. Whether you look at GDP, jobs, earnings, but also I think it's pretty clear that we seem to think that Southern Europe is one thing, but it's not actually. Well, we knew that already, but recent developments are showing that there is some considerable divergence. Portugal and Spain are doing quite well, relatively speaking. Italy seems to be stuck in stagnation, and Greece seems to be stuck in depression. So there are differences that are worth exploring. So the question is why? Well, an average economist, let alone a prominent economist, would tell you that growth in the short term can either be driven by various components of demand, either consumption or investment or exports. And in the long run, growth can only be determined by rising productivity. So let's have a look at these things and see what happens. Is productivity improving? What about investment? What about moving to a celebrated export-led growth model? Okay, one of the nicest things I think that we showed in the previous paper was that, there was austerity, it was very bad and so on, but if you look at the numbers more closely, you will realize that policymakers, not just in Southern Europe, throughout Europe, perhaps throughout the world, faced with rather unpalatable choices about what to cut, they decided to cut. They cut everything, but they cut more investment, because who cares about investment? You know, the effects will be shown in the future. Probably there will be another government, and you know, we'll think about investment later. There is no constituency actively lobbying for more investment, I think. So they cut investment much more than they cut consumption. And if you look at the numbers, that's clear. Even at EU level as a whole, there are 28 countries, final consumption expenditure was not cut that much in the EU 28, but gross fixed capital formation, public and private investment, because firms think alike to a great extent, was cut by almost 14%. In Greece, consumption was cut by 24%, investment by 61%. Spain, investment 35%, consumption 9%, and so on and so forth. So that's clear. The question is, and we talked about that in the previous paper, but that was the austerity. What about the recovery? Well, in the European Union taken together, the 28 countries, it seems that investment kind of bounced back. So people, governments and firms made up for lost ground. Investment grew by 10%, twice as fast as consumption, 5%. There is evidence that the same kind of pattern can be observed in the case of Spain and Portugal. Spain, 15% in 2013-2016, more than consumption, 6% of the same period. Portugal, 10 versus 5.5. In Greece, investment continues to be... there is a net loss in investment, and this is gross capital fixed formation. So if you take into account the fact that capital stock depreciates, net investment is even worse. So there is less investment in Greece than would have been necessary to keep the same kind of capital stock. So, and in Italy too, investment has grown only by 2.4% and consumption by 2.6%. That's low. All right. So, what happened during the austerity was justified but short-sighted all the same and spells trouble for the future. Let's look at productivity, which is the long-term determinant of growth, sustainable growth. Well, during the crisis in Europe as a whole, productivity improved a little by 5%. That means that the jobs that were destroyed during the austerity were less productive than the jobs that were saved. So on average, the economy was more productive, although it was also the size of the economy as a whole was smaller than it had been. But in the case of the EU 28, the economy didn't shrink that much. Well, in Southern European countries, where the shrinkage was more substantial, productivity stagnated in Italy, improved in Spain and Portugal, and fell, was reduced in Greece. What about the recovery? Well, in Italy, Portugal, and Greece, there was almost no change in productivity. if anything, productivity declined slightly. It only increased a little in Spain, in a context in which, in the European economy as a whole, productivity improved twice as fast as in Spain, almost 3%. Okay, what about exports? You know that South European countries have been actively encouraged by European policymakers to move from their awful, discredited, demand-led growth model to a more Teutonic export-led model. That raises a question of whether it is possible for all countries in the world to be net exporters. Who is going to import? But anyway, that's the idea behind many of the reforms and policies in recent years. So let's look at exports. There is no question that some revival of exports is necessary to revive Southern European economies, given that the stimulus coming from consumption and even from investment is not enough. So let's look at exports. Well, throughout Europe and in Southern Europe, the slump in exports was the year 2009. Thereafter, things improved, but not at the same rate in all countries. Portugal did better than average for the euro area, and Spain just as well. Italy, not that well, and Greece even worse. I think that's the leitmotif of my presentation, that Greece is not doing at all well, but we knew that already. So I think there is very strong evidence that, as I said before, within the group of four Southern European countries, there is considerable divergence. The reason Spain and Portugal are doing better seems clear. There is higher investment, there is faster productivity growth, and there is also better export performance in Spain and Portugal than it is in Greece and Italy. But it's not at all clear that that means that even Spain and Portugal, that are doing better than Italy and Greece, have shifted their path towards a more export-led growth model, in the sense that if you look at the broader shape of things, and you look at exports in Southern Europe as a proportion of all exports from the countries in the euro area, you will see that even the poster boys of my story, Spain and Portugal, have barely managed, they run faster to stand still, is this the expression? While in the case of Italy, there is a slow and steady decline in terms of market share, if you like. And, Greece was never a great exporter, and it's even less of a great exporter in recent years, in spite of the improvement in terms of, the absolute value of exports relative to 2009. So in terms of market share, even Spain and Portugal have just managed to maintain a rather steady market share, nearly 8% in the case of Spain, 1.5% in the case of Portugal. Of course, the other thing that our paper is going to look at is the contribution of structural reforms. Structural reforms is not exactly a euphemism. It means both labor market reforms and product market reforms. But given that product market reforms didn't go that far in Southern Europe, most of the time, you can use interchangeably the two terms, structural reforms and labor market reforms. Right. So in all four countries, the direction of reform was broadly similar. Let's make the labor markets more flexible and see what happens. Well, on the other hand, in terms of degree, intensity or radicalness of the reforms, Greece went further. But on the other hand, even in Spain and Italy, let alone Portugal, there was significant deregulation of labor markets. And yet, you may say, even though the recipe was the same, outcomes in terms of growth and even employment were different. So why? Well, one possibility would be to look at the, as I just said, to different starting points, but also different labor market reform, less radical in Spain and Portugal than in Greece, which actually reinforces the previous question. So if Spain and Portugal introduced less radical labor market reforms and then did better, perhaps that means that the reforms weren't such a good idea to start with. But it may also be that other things matter as well. For example, product market reforms. We would like to look at how product market reforms differed in the four countries. But I can't help feeling this nagging suspicion that perhaps structural reforms are not that important, and there are other things in the economy that may be more important, that bailout programs and reform programs didn't address. So, what about earnings? Well, we already said that earnings didn't grow, and with the rise of part-time work, it's often the case that the new jobs are less well paid than the ones they replaced. And you may argue that this was the explicit intention of the structural reforms. After all, the general idea, the overall objective was to engineer so-called internal devaluation. Since euro area members cannot devalue their currency, perhaps they can get out of trouble by devaluing prices and wages, especially wages. So it shouldn't be a surprise that wages didn't grow or fell in the first, in the previous period. But again, the fact that job creation was not as spectacular, it's less spectacular in Greece, which introduced more radical labor market reforms, than in Spain and Portugal that didn't. Seems like not exactly a good omen for whether labor market reforms were that justified in the first place. Of course, I have been discussing this point with several people, some of which quite sympathetic to internal devaluation, and always, yes, the counter argument is that you have to compare the situation that you are observing with the counterfactual, how things might have turned out if those reforms had not been implemented. We'll never know. Minimum wages is the case of minimum wages is indicative of what I was saying before. So, for example, in Greece, notoriously, minimum wages were cut by 22%, but in Portugal and Spain, they weren't. They were simply frozen for a few years and then raised again. In Portugal, minimum wages in real terms are 11.5% higher than they were before the crisis. And in Spain, taking into account the very recent increase in minimum wages, it's what? Almost 8% higher. And these graphs are showing you how in both Portugal and Spain, the gray-blue bars, minimum wages have risen above average wages and above prices. So there has been improvement in real terms. So that calls into question the nexus of minimum wages, job creation, and growth. And of course, this is a highly contested question. Those who defend structural reforms will tell you, first of all, that you don't know how things would have been without structural reforms, but also that the fact that Spain and Portugal have improved minimum wages and have experienced faster growth does not necessarily mean that it was the higher minimum wages that caused growth. It may have been actually the other way around, that it was high growth that enabled the governments or the social partners to agree to raise minimum wages. On the other hand, the case for the prosecution would be that when you weaken the bargaining position of workers and unions, which, because structural reforms, labor market reforms, did a lot of other things other than reducing or freezing minimum wages. Basically, they changed collective bargaining and the power, the limited the power of unions, of organized labor. So once this happens, you cannot expect that when the economy picks up, wages magically will improve. They may not, actually, simply because the balance of power is so much against workers now. But I think the other indictment of structural reforms is likely to be that by engineering internal devaluation, by reducing wages, what you do is that you kind of trap these economies in a kind of low road, low skill, low wage road, rather than encourage them to move on to a higher road. I'm not saying that it's enough to raise wages to move to a higher road, but there are so many other things that matter for productivity and higher value added that were neglected during the austerity, things to do with skill formation, or even things that are the responsibility of employers rather than labor. But it seems that the general idea was that once you break the influence of unions, everything else will fall into place. Well, it didn't. So this is not so much a criticism of the Troika. Well, it is, but it's more of a criticism, I think, to national political elites who have neglected very much all the other things that contribute to the higher road to a more sustainable growth model. Right, that's about it for me. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, first of all, I'm extremely grateful to Manos, because this was, in fact, the paper that we were supposed to be working on this semester, and various things came up, and so he's done a great head start. As Manos pointed out, this is part two to another paper that we finished and published that was about austerity, by which we mean changes in public spending and in taxation in these countries. And now we're trying to move on to the analysis of the ways in which labor regulation was changed in these countries and the consequences of that. And the common theme, and I think this came out quite clearly from Manos's presentation, is that we are very skeptical, and we think it's very important to be skeptical about some of the optimism and even perhaps triumphalism that has characterized some of the statements by European authorities recently about the recovery of economies of the economies of the Eurozone. And it is true that the Eurozone as a whole, an economy, a currency area that did much more badly than the American economy did, even though the crisis didn't necessarily start in Europe, it started in the United States, that it is recovering and that we are seeing growth, but that growth is distributed also very unequally. And it is true that some of these southern economies that were made to carry a lot of the brunt of the adjustment, that some of them are growing, but that growth isn't necessarily of the quality that we think of when we talk about recovery, because recovery, after all, implies that we are recovering a particular level of well-being. And so there are two features in particular. The first one, as Manos pointed out, is that even though we are seeing growth, GDP is growing again from some very big lows that it reached, but it is growing again in some of the southern countries. But employment is not recovering to the same extent that might be implied by unemployment rates. There's a lot of focus on unemployment rates, but as Manos pointed out, we really should be focusing on employment. How many people are actually working? And when we look at that, we see that the recovery isn't that great because there are far fewer people participating in the labor force. Some of the people have left, some of the people have dropped out. So we really need to look at employment figures rather than unemployment rates. And when we look at that, things really do not look so good. There's another feature to employment, and this is perhaps one that we could highlight a little bit more. It doesn't apply to everyone, but one of the things that we do see across all of these countries, with perhaps the exception of Italy, or Italy is perhaps the place where it has happened least, but it's that a lot of employment now is extraordinarily precarious. And what I mean by precarious is that the conditions of employment are very bad. Now, in the United States, we're quite used to precarious employment. It's sort of what we expect when we first start out as young people. But in the case of Europe, what we're seeing is that in some countries where employment is recovering, we're talking about jobs that last sometimes less than half a month. And those jobs count as a job. And so there's this new rise of precarious employment that is more precarious than before. And again, it's something that really needs to be taken into account. So the reason why we think that these points are very important to make is not that we want to be pessimists or that we want to be critics of the particular governments that are in government, the particular parties that are in government in these four countries, but rather that we think it's important to recognize that some of what has happened may have put these countries on a different path. And that path is not necessarily a better path. Yes, it may be that given everything else, given the kind of recession that countries in the Eurozone went into, even fewer people would have been employed if it had been any harder to employ people than it is now. But there are also long-term consequences. And it's some of these long-term consequences that we're particularly concerned about. And this is what political economists nowadays sometimes refer to as growth paths. You can grow, but you can grow in different ways. You can grow with higher quality work. You can grow with higher wages. You can grow with more sustainable pension systems into the future, or you can grow with lower wages and less sustainable pensions into the future. And yet in both cases, if GDP is growing, it counts as growth. So what we're concerned about is what are some of the long-term consequences of these changes. And here what I want to point out is that there's a short-term story, and it may very well be that in the short term, it's better for someone who otherwise isn't going to have a job to have a 10-day job than to have no job. But that kind of experience has other consequences. It has consequences in terms of human capital. It has consequences for the ability of individuals to invest in their futures. And as I pointed out earlier, it has consequences for old age pension systems, because people who work in very poor jobs are not going to be contributing to pensions in the same way. So these are some of the warnings that we want to put out there. And then I don't want to take too much time, but it is kind of my part of the paper that hasn't quite been developed yet. But there's also the fact that none of what we have discussed so far has looked at the political consequences. And we do also see that there are political consequences. We don't only see this in Southern Europe. We don't only see this in Europe. We see this in the United States. But there have been big political consequences. And we shouldn't necessarily assume that those political consequences are going to be positive ones either. I think that there is, in all the states of Southern Europe, there has been a big focus on corruption. We have corruption scandals going on in various countries that are very much in the press. And there's also been a tendency of the population to view their experience in terms of having faulty politicians, faulty domestic politicians. Okay, so there's an easy way in which people, voters, are connecting corruption scandals to their economic malaise, to the deterioration, say, of employment conditions. And that's not to say that corruption is good, for heaven's sakes, but there may be not that much of a connection between the two. It may be that some of the deterioration in work conditions has a whole lot more to do with economic policies, and we do want to get rid of corrupt politicians, but are the kinds of politicians and the kinds of movements and the kinds of arguments that we see arising in countries like Greece or Italy or Spain, there's been somewhat less change in the case of Portugal, are those good things? Or do we simply have political situations that are actually going to make things harder in the future? So that's kind of a last question that I wanted to just bring up. It's one that we aren't necessarily answering, but it's the other side of the story that also needs to be added. Okay, and so having taken a lot of time, I think what I want to do is stop right now and just see what kinds of questions people have. Give you an opportunity to participate. And please, if you have a question, when you take the mic, please tell us who you are.
My name is Yura Avizyanyas, and I teach on the writing program. And I was just wondering if you could say, if you have any idea why Portugal is doing so much better compared to the other southern European nations. And also I was wondering about the fact that I think one of the simplistic explanations for Greece's slow recovery or non-recovery is the fact that it's in the Eurozone and it couldn't devalue its currency. Is there, and I know your talk talked about all the other different variables, but do you think that being able to devalue its currency would have speeded up the recovery?
Well, I just finished a paper on why Grexit is a terrible idea, so my answer is no. It's coming out in the Open Forum series of Center for European Studies, Harvard. No, I don't think that's the case. And after all, Portugal, Spain, and Italy are also part of the Eurozone, and that hasn't prevented Portugal and Spain to do better than Greece. I'm sure Sophia has things to say about that. Portugal is my favorite country, by the way. I like it so much that the political climate is so mild, and, you know, the pro-austerity Socialist Party is now heading a minority government which is supported by the anti-austerity radical left. Well, in my country, Greece, the moderate left and the radical left don't speak to each other except to exchange insults. Never mind, you don't want to know everything about that. So I think the mildness of the political culture is certainly part of the answer, but many other things. Portugal, the Portuguese economy is better integrated in global value chains, for example. They have been smarter. The current prime minister used to be the mayor of Lisbon, and one of his achievements, which is controversial, is that he used the so-called digital economy, Airbnb and so on, to kickstart the economy of his city, Lisbon. And he's very much into innovation and things like that. For example, when we prepared for the previous paper, we came across a paper by a Portuguese professor which went on about innovation and brain drain and so on. And we thought, wow, what a great paper. And then we found out that this guy had become the general secretary for research and development. You know, he had a government post giving him the chance to actually do something about the things he cared. So that's great. It didn't happen in Greece. I can't speak about Italy because it's a completely different country in that sense. And, you know, there are differences that are worth investigating more closely. And
I would just add a couple of points. When we wrote the previous paper on, we were particularly concerned with inequality and how much inequality had risen. And in terms of aggregate measures, Portugal did quite well. I do think that, compared to the other countries, it should be said, right? I do think it's important not to romanticize what's happening in any one particular quarter or year And, you know, I do think it's a little bit dangerous to say, well, Portugal did great because it did a little bit better than these other countries. That isn't to say that everything is rosy in Portugal, as some of our Portuguese colleagues pointed out to us. So, you know, I'd be a little bit careful. The Portuguese did, they do have a particular political history. It's a small country. It's a consensus-oriented country to some extent. And that did contribute to make some policies more redistributive in that country than in some of the other countries. But I think we need to be careful not to romanticize that. The other point I wanted to make is that I think it's very important. It's obvious that what has happened in all four of these countries has a lot to do with the fact that they are members of the Eurozone. In fact, a lot of the problems that arose that made them so vulnerable was directly related to the fact that they became members of the Eurozone. I do think it's important to distinguish between would it have been easier had all of that not been the case, and would it be better now, given what has happened, to somehow leave the euro, which I think is something that can be extraordinarily destructive in and of itself. So I do think it's different to, you know, just because it might have been better not to participate in the first place, that doesn't mean that the solution now is to leave, I think. And those are two things that are sometimes confused. Well, thank you very much for coming today. And thank you very much for your comments and questions.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Manos Matsiganis, Associate Professor of Public Finance at Polytechnic University of Milan, Italy. Professor Matsiganis' lecture was titled The Political Economy of Recovery in Southern Europe 2014 to 2018 and was presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies. Tonight's moderator was Sophia Perez, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette and Mike Moschetto. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydonis. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.